I don't care that Israel invented the cherry tomato. I want my neighbor to be able to freely move between cities and towns without having to show his ID to a heavily armed young conscript. And I don't think that that's too much to ask. I don't think that's so radical.
Welcome to Unsettled, a new podcast about Israel, Palestine, and the Jewish diaspora. We are here to provide a space for difficult conversations and diverse viewpoints that are all too rare in American Jewish communities. My name is Max Friedman. I'm one of the producers of Unsettled and your host for today's episode. If you heard our teaser episode, you'll know that the producers of this podcast are all involved with the anti-occupation movement If Not Now, though Unsettled is not affiliated with If Not Now. I met today's guest, Rachel Roberts, at a presentation she gave in June for If Not Now members called Occupation 101. Now, when I was growing up, I was told point blank by Jewish educators that the Israeli occupation of the West Bank was not a thing. Occupation was a bad word. So I wanted to interview Rachel for two reasons. First, because I think she does a really good job breaking down some of the basic facts of the occupation that our community does not want to talk about. And second, because, well, If Not Now has only been around since 2014, and most of the people I've met through the movement have been, like me, pretty new to this work. Rachel, on the other hand, has been a Jewish activist for Palestinian rights for almost 15 years. Her experiences provide some really important context for the growing number of American Jews who are just now feeling ready to engage. Before we get started, I want to quickly explain a few references she makes in the first part of the interview. The right of return refers to the principle that Palestinians who were forced to leave their homes in what is now Israel during the War of 1948, as well as their descendants, should have the right to return to those homes and reclaim them or receive compensation. When Rachel talks about the seminary, she means the Jewish Theological Seminary, where she got an M.A. in Biblical Studies and Ancient Semitic Languages. And Alan Dershowitz is a retired professor of law at Harvard University and the author of many books, including The Case for Israel. A quick note, we taped this interview in Brooklyn, New York, in the summertime, and you might hear a car engine or an ice cream truck here and there. One more thing. If you're wondering why you're hearing about the occupation from an American Jew instead of a Palestinian who has actually lived under occupation, I'm right there with you. In an upcoming episode, we will feature an interview with Suleiman Khatib from Combatants for Peace. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss it. And now, without further ado, the first question I want to ask you is, what do you do and why?
For my day job, I'm an attorney. I was a civil rights lawyer for several years in the Muslim community, and now I have just sort of a boring DC contract job, which frees me up to do a lot of volunteer work. I've been a Palestine solidarity activist since the year 2003, and I became active in Palestine solidarity work really at the height of the Second Intifada, when things were very, very hard. The Iraq war was about to start, and we had just experienced September 11th in New York City. And I was a young 20-something who had been raised basically on Israel right or wrong. I had been raised in a very, very Zionist environment. My grandfather made Aliyah with his wife and young daughter in 1968. And my family was very ideologically committed to Zionism and committed to Israel. And so when I finally began to learn a little bit about the situation in Israel-Palestine, you know, it really broke my heart, definitely. And I felt like I had to do something. I had to get involved. And I found a group of young Jews on the Lower East Side of Manhattan who were meeting every week. They called themselves Jews Against the Occupation. From there, I joined the International Solidarity Movement. I became the media coordinator in 2007. I studied at a Palestinian university. I attended Bir Zeit University. And I've been working with Palestine solidarity groups basically since then, like in various capacities.
And what happened in 2003 that got you involved?
It was really more late 2002 when things were really, really monstrous in Israel-Palestine. A number of civilians were killed in the refugee camp in Jenin, and that was all over the news. There was just a lot of consternation in the community and abroad, and I had a friend who was a Palestinian playwright, and she invited me to a reading of one of her plays. And we had had a couple of conversations about Israel-Palestine, the fact that I was Jewish and she was Palestinian, but I thought that it was going to be another work about Arab-American identity that was going to make me feel comfortable. And it was a play about four Palestinian women at the gates of the afterlife. It talked about the Nakba. I had never heard before that 750,000 Palestinians were forced from their homes in 1948. I'd never heard that more than 450 Palestinian towns and villages were razed at the creation of the State of Israel. I really thought that I knew everything that there was to know about Israel-Palestine. And watching this play really, like, it kind of shook me up. It kind of, it made me feel like maybe I don't know anything. And I thank this woman. Her name's Betty Shamia. She's now a Guggenheim Fellow. She's still my friend. I thank her every time I see her, which is unfortunately not frequent. She lives in San Francisco these days. But I saw that play, and I did a lot of digging on the internet. It was just kind of a long, quiet journey that I took really by myself until I met the Jews Against the Occupation, which there wasn't really a group like If Not Now. Jews Against the Occupation was much more radical. They supported the right of return. They supported an end to U.S. military aid. They supported an end to the occupation. Back, like, when the Jewish community just simply was not talking about these things, like not talking about them at all. And we were considered a very, very radical group. We had no support from anyone within the Jewish establishment and the Jewish community. And we had to do for ourselves.
Is Jews Against the Occupation still around?
No. Jews Against the Occupation disbanded, I think, in 2006. They didn't have very much infrastructure. Like, we never really laid down organizational infrastructure. And it was only a New York City group. So the way that it used to work was that there were a bunch of different Jewish groups all around the country that were organizing against the occupation, but they didn't have the same organizational culture and didn't have the same ideology. So most of the other groups that were operating, a lot of them were sort of coming left from Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, which was the big liberal Zionist group at the time. And I think that they eventually folded into J Street. But in New York City, Jews Against the Occupation was the only show in town when it came to Jewish organizing. And at one point, I can remember, especially after the Iraq War started, and there was stuff happening out in the streets every single weekend. There was one meeting that I attended that was over 100 people. Like, it was crazy. We were all at the CUNY Grad Center, and it was just impossible to have a meeting because there were just so many people who wanted to be part of this group. But without infrastructure, without funding, without a real, like, basis, it basically fell apart. And there were also some, like, internal things that were happening. And frankly, history was happening. The politics of the occupation were shifting. After the Intifada stopped and Mahmoud Abbas was elected president of the Palestinian Authority, the political situation on the ground shifted considerably. And it became just a lot more routinized and stabilized. It wasn't the same crisis point to organize around. And I think that that meant that political organizing around Palestine abroad changed as well. There was just as much support, like, ideologically, but not as much activity, which happens. Like, there are high points, there are low points, there are ebbs and flows in this work, and there's not really a whole lot that you can do to predict when those times come, you know?
Can you talk about the stigma attached to advocating in the Jewish community about Israel-Palestine and how that has shifted over time?
At the time that I started, it was impossible to say that you were even against the occupation. Everyone was in favor of peace. Everyone was in favor of two states. But the slogan of Hillel in those days was, wherever we stand with Israel. And people at the seminary definitely made it clear that that basically we were expected to keep our criticisms inside the family. And that was said explicitly. It wasn't something that people made an effort to sort of be subtle about suggesting. It was, if you speak out against Israel in public, you're going to embolden anti-Semites, you're going to embolden the enemies of Israel, you could contribute to terrorism and to attacks against innocent Israelis and Jews overseas. That to speak out against the occupation was dangerous. And people would say frequently to me that it was fine to criticize Israel, that they criticized Israel every day, but there was no meaningful discussion about what the problems really were. No one really wanted to get down into the weeds of what was causing the problems that Israel faced in the world. So for me personally, like, I started to realize that it was kind of, that it was bullshit, that people were just like talking past each other and having these like not at all meaningful discussions of what was going on, and that these were important issues like for our future. If we're young Jewish people in the world and we're going to be taking the reins of this community at some point in the future, we need to be able to know what it is the other side is thinking about us, what the rest of the world is thinking about us. I started my journey simply wanting to do research, wanting to understand how it was that someone could ever side against Israel, because the case for Israel, I found it to be terribly persuasive. Right? I thought that like Alan Dershowitz was a really smart guy and had all these wonderful things to say in his book. And when I started reading other materials, I began to realize that something was amiss. And when I started to say out loud, you guys, something is amiss. Like, what about, you know, these Palestinians who were forced from their homes? Like, how do I answer them? And people would get very uncomfortable. There would be like kind of smiles. People would want to change the subject. It was really hard. And eventually, I just wound up leaving that environment altogether. And I didn't have a Jewish community for, I would say, like 8 years. Like, I wasn't properly part of a Jewish community until I moved to Washington, D.C., which was only 3 years ago. I would say that now, with your generation, things are getting better. And frankly, it's because of Jewish millennials. I hear a lot of people hating on millennials, and I actually love the millennials. I feel like you guys are far more open than the generations that came before. You know, there's stuff that, like, I don't really understand. But to be honest, it's really refreshing because people want to ask questions. When something negative is expressed, people aren't freaked out by it. They want that to lead to more conversation, not to a shutting down of conversation. I definitely feel like in the Jewish community, especially for baby boomers and Gen Xers, absolutely picked up the reins of this, that they wanted to have a very narrow, circumscribed conversation and not have a really direct and honest conversation. And I feel like now, finally, people are starting to understand that in order to solve these problems, we have to get very, very honest, and we have to, like, face some uncomfortable truths, you know?
At this point, I asked Rachel to talk about Occupation 101, the curriculum she created with the education team from If Not Now DC. But just a heads up, if you're new to this subject, Rachel does get pretty deep into the weeds of geography and policy. Many of the terms she uses, she does go on to explain, and we'll have links to a lot more information on our website, unsettledpod.com. But one thing she talks about that I'd like to take a moment to define is permanent residency. Permanent residents of Israel are issued an Israeli ID but are not full citizens. They cannot vote in national elections and are legally stateless. Permanent residency can also be revoked by the Israeli government with little warning. 88% of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem are permanent residents. The reasons for that could fill another episode. So, as it turns out, the presentation I had watched Rachel give the night before we spoke was just one of several she has in the works, separating out the distinct challenges of East Jerusalem, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and Palestinian refugees.
We've broken it down into different modules, and the first one that I delivered last night was the module on the West Bank. And so I talked about both settlements and military rule, which is a good sort of basic introduction to what a military occupation is, what it's supposed to be under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and the ways in which Israel defies the Fourth Geneva Convention in the course of maintaining its occupation and expanding its control over the West Bank.
What does the Fourth Geneva Convention say?
So Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention places certain obligations on occupiers. And an occupier is a sovereign nation that has taken over a piece of territory, usually in a war, but none of the, like, basically the world community does not recognize that it has sovereignty over that territory. It's supposed to be a temporary hold for defensive purposes. And so the Fourth Geneva Convention puts forward certain obligations on the state that is occupying territory. And all of the obligations that are placed on the occupier are basically designed to make sure that the character of the territory is not changed at all, and also that the people who live within that territory are protected as civilians. So with its settlements, Israel has absolutely sought to change the character of the territory that it occupies, and many people believe annex it to Israel. The settlements are not intended to be part of a future Palestinian state, but are rather intended to be part of Israel, which would indicate, I think, to most reasonable people that Israel has no intention of ever giving that territory back. If Israel were maintaining an occupation for defensive purposes, for security reasons, there would be a series of military installations along the 1949 armistice line, which was the previous border of Israel after what Israelis call the War for Independence, and nothing else. But instead, deep into the West Bank, including into the Jordan Valley, which is right up to the border of Jordan, which is the next neighboring country, Israel has built all of these settlements. Additionally, there is the issue of the wall. So we discussed the wall that Israel began building in the early 2000s. And I was actually in Palestine for the first time in 2004 when the wall was first being built. And
what was that like?
I mean, when you see it up close, you realize, like, what a joke it is that Israel maintains that this is for security. The wall was built down business streets, like, specifically to basically destroy the Palestinian businesses that existed in this street. And if you go to Bethlehem, where I was recently, the wall that was built there basically culls in this family's home on three sides. It was clearly designed to be a land grab. And when you look at it on a map, you can see that the route of the wall actually snakes in, like, deep inside of the Green Line and creates sort of like fingers that basically prevent contiguity in the West Bank, which is necessary. If you want to have a state, you need to have contiguous territory on which to build that state. You need to have a reasonable mode of transport for goods, services, and people. You need to have a way out. And the wall basically prevents that from ever occurring. But especially now, I think it's become quite clear. The wall was never finished. Like, people don't seem to realize this, but the wall was never properly finished. And I showed a photograph that was taken by Active Stills, which is a great organization that does photography on the ground in Israel-Palestine, of Palestinians going to worship during Ramadan and climbing up and over the wall on a ladder. Tens of thousands of Palestinian workers get into Israel to work illegally every single day. So if workers could get into Israel, then suicide bombers could also theoretically get into Israel. Why are there no more suicide bombings, and there haven't been for 10 years? It's because the factions themselves decided against that tactic all those years ago. And because when Arafat died, Mahmoud Abbas decided to start security cooperation with Israel. And many Palestinians will tell you, like today, that the PA is simply an arm of the Israeli security. So it's sort of an interesting dynamic.
If you're saying that there are no more suicide bombings in part because of the security cooperation between the PA and Israel, mm-hmm. tell me why that's a bad thing.
First of all, I don't support armed resistance at all in my own work. I have dedicated my own work purely to nonviolence. And I also, like, have, you know, don't defend, like, attacks on civilians. I think that they do violate international law. But the reason why PA security cooperation with Israel is a bad thing is because the way that Israel treats Palestinians is generally bad. Israel will sometimes take Palestinians and place them under administrative detention for months at a time, which means that you're basically incarcerated without charges. And the PA is now participating in that system. As Diana Boutu wrote recently in the New York Times, Palestinians are the most surveilled people on earth, and it's happening from their own leadership.
Let's pretend that I am you in 2001. I read Alan Dershowitz's book.
It wasn't out in 2001. It came out in like 2004, 2005, The Case for Israel. Mm-hmm.
Let's say that it's 2004, 2005, and I'm not as enlightened as you were by the time we got to 2004, 2005, and I read Alan Dershowitz's book or some other book, and I thought that those arguments sounded really good.
Yeah.
What would you say to me?
I would encourage anyone who has read The Case for Israel to think about what exactly the points that he's making. I mean, the thing that really sort of irritated me when I read that book was the fact that he points to Israel's advances in the biotechnology industry to justify human rights violations against Palestinians. I mean, why do we have to talk about Israel as a productive society? Why do we have to talk about gay rights, about pink washing, in order to justify what Israel is doing to the Palestinians? I mean, ultimately, human rights violations are human rights violations, and we should want to solve them. Occupation is occupation, and we should want to end the occupation, regardless of what other good things Israel might do. The United States does plenty of good things, right? And did plenty of good things before the end of Jim Crow. But it was necessary in this country to make sure that every citizen was guaranteed equal protection under the law. And it's still necessary for us to be fighting those battles, right? It's not about shame or blame. It's about taking responsibility for the future and solving problems. What ultimately turned me off about The Case for Israel, and frankly, a lot of the other books that came out for Hasbara, is that they felt like camouflage. They felt like they were sort of throwing a cover, like, don't look over here, look over here. You know, let's talk about the fact that Israel invented the cherry tomato. I don't care that Israel invented the cherry tomato. I want my neighbor to be able to freely move between cities and towns without having to show his ID to a heavily armed young conscript. I want Palestinians to be able to marry who they want. I want them to live as free people in their land, same as I live as a free person in my land. And I don't think that that's too much to ask. I don't think that's so radical.
Palestinians can't marry who they want?
That's correct. First of all, there is no civil marriage in Israel. I think most people who are Jewish understand that you have to marry a Jew if you want to get married in the state of Israel, or if you're not a Jew, you have to marry someone of the same religion. Otherwise, you have to go abroad, and then the state will come in and recognize your marriage. For Palestinians, there are additional hurdles. First of all, many Palestinians are not allowed to access the country. So, for instance, I have a friend whose fiance was given a 10-year bar. She was a Palestinian American. She wanted to come to Palestine, marry him, be with him in the West Bank. And Israel denied her entry and then gave her a 10-year bar. And that effectively ended their relationship. Because what happened was he got arrested, was held in administrative detention, and then was subject to a travel ban, which prevented him from leaving the country. So she couldn't get in, he couldn't get out, and that effectively ended their relationship. Palestinians within, so 1 in 5 Israelis is a Palestinian. They're sometimes referred to as Arab Israelis, but a lot of Palestinians within prefer to be called Palestinians within because they think that the term Israeli Arab erases their Palestinianness. So I respect that and just refer to them as Palestinians within. For Palestinians within, they have additional hurdles in getting, if you want to bring your spouse who is in the West Bank to come and live with you for family unification, in Israel, you're not allowed to marry someone who is a citizen of an enemy state. And guess what's considered an enemy state? That's right. The Palestinian Authority is considered an enemy state.
Even though it's not a state.
Even though it's not a state, and Israel has full effective control over the entire West Bank. So it's a huge obstacle. And then there are the people who marry in the 90s it was slightly easier, but Palestinians from abroad who wanted to come and marry their spouses who were Palestinians within, now many of them still have permanent residency. And Omar Barghouti, who is the head of the Boycott National Committee, is a permanent resident in Israel and lives with his spouse, his wife, who is a Palestinian within. And now Israel is trying to take away his permanent residency on account of his political activities. This is something that simply would not happen to a Jew. And you or I, like tomorrow morning, if we wanted to get on a flight to Tel Aviv, get off the plane and go get automatic citizenship, we could. We would get automatic, not only automatic citizenship, but car loans, education grants. We would get deeply discounted appliances, all sorts of education and language training, like whatever we wanted, simply by virtue of the fact that the two of us were born Jewish. It doesn't matter if you have never been there before in your life. Meanwhile, a Palestinian does not have that same right. They can't bring their partner over. They can't bring their relatives over. And the Palestinian probably speaks Hebrew better than you or I do. They certainly speak Arabic better than you or I do. And they have a sense of the place. I mean, it can deeper ties to the place than you or I do. And these are the problems that we need to grapple with. Like, we need to, if we want to figure out where we stand as Jews, like in the future, we need to really be thinking hard about what a Jewish state means and what Israel's policies mean for the Palestinians and for us.
So you've referred to the Palestinian Authority a couple times.
Yeah.
What is the Palestinian Authority? How did it come to be?
So in 1993, Israel signed an agreement with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was considered the Palestinian leadership in exile. There were also Palestinian leaders who were on the ground in Palestine, who were the leaders of what was known as the First Intifada. This agreement was made with Yasser Arafat and the PLO. There was a famous handshake on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton, Yitzhak Rabin, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, and Yasser Arafat. And as a result of that agreement, a Palestinian autonomous region was determined. And I don't know that on your podcast, like, we have time to get into the details of areas A, B, and C and what happened in 1994, 1995. But basically what happened was an authority was set up that was intended to be temporary. It was intended to govern the affairs of the Palestinian people and to take that burden off of Israel and to gradually shift everything over to what would become the new Palestinian state. The new Palestinian state never emerged. Throughout the 90s, settlement construction continued unabated. And in fact, I showed graphs last night that indicated that in the 1990s, settlement growth was basically a straight 45-degree angle. It didn't really stop. And ultimately, it's now the year 2017, and the Palestinian Authority is still in place. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So in your own life, and as you've gone around talking to other people about the occupation and what goes on in Israel-Palestine, what are the most common cliches or false talking points that you hear and have to counteract?
I mean, I think that the biggest obstacle to talking about this topic is the idea that Israel's occupation is maintained for the security of Israelis. I think that once you get into the weeds, once you get into the details of how the occupation functions, of the ways in which Palestinians have been deprived of their liberty and of their freedom, I mean, their basic rights, you begin to see the ways in which the security idea falls apart. I mean, if these people are so dangerous, then why is Israel subsidizing civilian communities to move right in next to their villages? Why is it that Israeli settlers like Baruch Marzel feel comfortable building a house right smack dab in the middle of where several Palestinian families are living? And the answer is that it's never been about security. It has always been about appropriating more territory for Israel. And in that respect, like Mark Levine and Neve Gordon wrote a very interesting article recently that says maybe we shouldn't even talk about it in terms of occupation anymore, because what it is an attempted annexation. And so we have to get real about that. But for Jews especially, I think that the security rationale is a very, very powerful trigger because of the history of the 20th century, because of the Holocaust, because of the pogroms, because of everything that our ancestors suffered through. And so we have to have a very honest reckoning with ourselves about what we're looking at. That's the hardest part with the Jews, is getting past the fear. The idea that Palestinians, by virtue of them being Palestinian, are dangerous for us. Do you know what I mean?
What are the most common things that people believe that are just false?
Oh, I mean, people tend not to know that Israel fired the first shot in 1967. I tend not to get into big debates about the history of the 1967 war, because I think that what comes after 1967 is so much more salient to what we're talking about. But most people believe that Egypt attacked Israel when in fact Israel fired the first shot. It's true that Egypt was making aggressive moves in 1967 that resulted in President Johnson declaring that Israel had a reason to fire the first shot, but Israel fired the first shot. Most people don't know that at all. Also, in 1948, like around the Nakba, which is what Palestinians, the word that Palestinians use to refer to the 1948 displacement, people tend not to know that, like, the Deir Yassin massacre happened a full month before Israel declared statehood. Like, it happened before May 15th, 1948. It happened in April of 1948.
And what was the Deir Yassin massacre?
So the Deir Yassin massacre happened when a Zionist militia that included among its members Menachem Begin, who became prime minister of Israel, they took over this village. They claimed that it was for military necessity, and 100 civilians were massacred. This was something that was resoundingly condemned by various members of the Jewish community. Albert Einstein wrote a very famous letter about it when Menachem Begin attempted to enter the United States the next year. But there were several massacres that occurred during the course of 1947 and 1948, beginning, I believe, in November of 1947 is when the militias started to go through the countryside and people began to be forced from their homes.
What do you think are the most important things that American Jews need to know about Israel-Palestine that they don't know?
The most important thing, well, you know something? I think that the most important thing for Americans generally, not just American Jews, is how involved we are over there. People tend to be very condescending to both Israelis and Palestinians, claiming that it's about religion, that it's about, you know, that it's like an age-old conflict that's lasted thousands of years. That's total nonsense. The reason why is because our foreign policy has been one of the key obstacles to Israelis and Palestinians getting what they need. And that's something that we need to do a whole lot better. We need to be pushing our lawmakers to do a whole lot better on this topic. And we cannot simply leave it to AIPAC as we have.
So. Can you say more about that? What has been America's foreign policy, and how is that getting in the way?
Well, the United States has given more than $121 billion to Israel, according to a recent report by the Congressional Research Service. And we recently signed a memorandum of understanding that will give Israel an additional $30 billion over the next 10 years. We supply them with weapons. When peace negotiations were in progress, the United States basically acted as Israel's lawyer. That phrase appears frequently in the press. The United States has given Israel a totally wide berth to expand settlements, to do everything basically that it wants to do. and to prevent Palestinians from getting what they need. And so we need to demand better. I think that the biggest thing that American Jews can do is to start focusing on American foreign policy, is to start to really look at those State Department reports and figure out why Congress is passing resolution after resolution praising Israel, giving Israel more money, giving Israel more weapons, and demand that they do better.
All right. Well, thank you again so much for being on Unsettled.
Thank you.
Since we taped this interview, Rachel and the If Not Now DC education team have continued developing their Occupation 101 curriculum and hope to bring it to a city near you. In the meantime, you can follow Rachel Roberts on Twitter at Rachel Hinda, that's RachelHinda, and at her blog, notesfromexile.com. At the end of our conversation, I asked Rachel to recommend some books and documentaries for listeners who want to learn more about the occupation. You'll find those resources on our website, unsettledpod.com. Unsettled is produced by Emily Bell, Asaf Calderon, Yoshi Fields, Ilana Levinson, and Max Friedman. That's me. This episode was edited by Max Friedman. Original music is by Nat Rosenzweig. Special thanks to Mark Winston Griffith and Brooklyn Deep. Go to our website, unsettledpod.com, for show information. You can now support Unsettled by becoming a monthly sustainer through Patreon. Unsettled is an entirely independent project, and your contribution can really help us keep going. Like us on Facebook, find us on Twitter and Instagram, and most importantly, subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss an episode of Unsettled.